Welcome to Frenzy on the Podcast, right here on Movie City News. I'm Noah Forrest, and I'm your host. Today, I have Kurt Kinney on. He's the director of the film Dear Zachary. It's a documentary, and I gotta say, it is the best documentary I've seen so far this year. It's really a movie that everyone should see. I can't recommend it enough to everyone, and when you hear my phone call with Kurt, you'll hear me say that a few more times. So, without any further ado, let's talk to Kurt Kinney, director of Dear Zachary. So I just wanted to start by saying, first of all, that I've seen a lot of documentaries this year, and yours was by far the best in terms of everything, pretty much. I mean, it's just an extraordinary, extraordinary film, and I urge anybody who's listening to this to please go out and see it, because it is really incredible. So,
thank you. Thanks for saying that.
Yeah, of course. And I just wanted to say, you know, all right, well, I guess we should, you know, for the benefit of the audience, talk about a little bit about what the movie's about. And
sure.
So do you want to kind of give a brief overview?
Sure.
Maybe a little bit about, you know, how, you know, you came up with the idea to make this movie as well.
Yeah, it originally started out as a personal project I was doing. I mean, I'm a filmmaker by trade anyway. I had made one previous feature documentary about the history of drive-in movie theaters that I'd actually just finished at the time that Andrew Bagby was murdered. Dr. Andrew Bagby was my closest friend from the age of probably about seven. We met in first grade. And then he was murdered on November 5th, 2001, and when I got the news, I immediately thought, the first thing I wanted to do was put together some kind of a tribute film for family, friends, and others to just to have, something to keep. And it also started occurring to me that, I was never, there were never going to be any more personal events. Like, he was never going to have a wedding at which I was finally going to meet, like, this whole side of his family I'd always heard about, or, his medical school friends from Canada, or all these kind of things. And so I started realizing that if I sort of really, took on this tribute film and made it really something special, it would be a really good excuse for me to go visit all these people that I was never going to otherwise get to meet.
Right.
Because, and making the movie was kind of a good excuse to do that, because I just emotionally wanted to go to these places, like see the hospital where he was working, go visit the places he talked about visiting his family when he was younger, go meet all these people. I thought if I just showed up and said, hey, I just want to meet you, people might think I was weird. Mm-hmm. But because I had the excuse of interviewing them for this tribute film I was doing, everyone wanted to participate, and so that was good. So that was originally how it started. It was never supposed to be released publicly. It was just something I was doing because I wanted to. And then, within a month of Andrew's murder, it came to light that he had been, likely murdered by his ex-girlfriend, who he had been trying to break up with the weekend that he was killed. She fled to Canada to avoid prosecution, and then discovered and announced about 4 months later, while we were still in the process of trying to extradite her back to the United States, that she was pregnant with his child. At the time, we didn't know if that was true. It turned out to be true. They did do DNA tests later and whatnot. When I got that news, I had already started planning this tribute movie I was going to make, and then I was suddenly thinking, oh, wow, I have a bigger responsibility here because I'm the only filmmaker friend Andrew had. And I made movies from the time I was about 7 years old as well, too, and I used to force Andrew to star in all of them, and I still had the raw footage tapes from all those movies that we'd shot, like on VHS and Super VHS, so I had Andrew's entire youth documented on tape.
Right.
So I was kind of the only conduit through which his son, who was named Zachary, would ever get to see who his dad was, hear him talk, and see what he was like, and meet him. So it suddenly became kind of this real mission that I had to do. I really felt it was my responsibility. I was the only one who could possibly do it.
Right.
So,
and that's some of the most affecting, stuff in the movie is the footage of you know, the movies you shot when you were younger, I mean, especially for, I mean, for me personally, because, I mean, I did the same thing when I was a kid. You know, you get your friends together, you shoot something on, you know, a camcorder, you know.
Sure.
I just wish I had kept all the tapes like you had, clearly. But,
yeah, I'm a bit of a pack rat. My mom was always trying to get me to, like, get rid of those because they were still being stored at my folks' house. I'm like, do you really need these? What do you need these for? I said, I want to keep them. You never know. And then after Andrew was killed, I said, see, aren't you glad I kept these? And she's like, well, okay, but who knew? Well, yeah, I said, oh, it doesn't matter. I wanted them, you know.
I have a hard time
throwing away personal pieces of nostalgia from the past, you know, so for whatever reason.
Well, clearly that can be a virtue, you know, so.
And obviously, as you can see from the film also, too, I tend to, even if somebody leaves a voicemail message for me that has a particular meaning or something, I'll record it and keep it, and that turned out to be very useful in putting this movie together because I got a lot of voicemail messages that turned out that they could be used as sort of informational plot points, if you will, you know, in this movie.
Absolutely.
That was a surprise to me, too. But.
Yeah, I mean, it's really very skillful the way you kind of edit together all these little bits of information to something that kind of resembles a Hollywood movie. Yeah, I mean, it's almost too perfect in a way. I mean, you have this, you know, the heroes, you know, which are Andrew's parents, and then you have, mm-hmm. Clearly this villain, and but anyway, I want to back up a little bit, and I mean, I wanted to talk a little bit about, I mean, as a filmmaker, I mean, clearly when you started making the film, you couldn't know how it would end. And as a filmmaker in general, you know, does that worry you in terms of, you know, making sure that you have a story that's cinematic? Or since this was such a personal project, you weren't even thinking in those terms?
No, this is a difficult question to answer for people who haven't seen the movie, obviously, because there's
right.
You know, certain things that are best left for the audience to discover when they watch the film for
absolutely.
The first time.
Absolutely, yeah.
But this movie, the answer to worrying about that was no, not at all, because I was not making the film for general release. There were people along the way who asked me, like, are you going to release this? And at the time, I'd said, no, I think that's exploitative of Andrew's family and whatnot, and creating it for Zachary and for the family, and that's not something that I think is necessary or right to do. But after certain events unfolded, it became necessary to tell this story publicly, to speak out for change to Canada's bail system, which I, in my feeling, as those who see the movie you can see, really, really failed my friend's family in a major way. And so that's the only reason it was released publicly, was to try to, you know, influence change, really. Because otherwise, I'd be very happy to not have the film released and have things be better in our personal lives, shall we say. But that didn't turn out to be the case.
Yeah. Well, I think for anyone who watches this movie, it's very hard not to hate the Canadian legal system afterwards. They really did a number on everyone. But anyway, but I do have to urge everyone to see the movie, you know, because you don't know what you're missing. But anyway, I mean, you're very much a part of this story, clearly. Was it always your intention, you know, I mean, as you're putting the footage together, to make yourself, you know, an important figure in the movie, or were there any thoughts of, like, trying to be more objective, you know, like, can you talk a little bit about the process, I guess, of editing the film and finding the, you know, the spine, I guess?
Well, I always saw the movie, ever since the moment I found out that Andrew was going to have a child, I always saw this project as my personal testament to his son. So in that sense, the movie is what the title says, a letter to a son about his father, so it's from me to him. So I never thought of it any other way, in terms of, there's no being objective about, you know, a personal statement, you know. So
right, right.
That was, and to claim to be would not fit with what the movie is, which is a, you know, a personal statement, but also would just be lying too. And I, for the record, I don't think anything anyone creates can ever be objective. I think you always have your own personal, you know, feelings influencing it, regardless of how hard you try. But in this case, I thought that the only reason that you know, even given that I was finally preparing this version for a general audience, I thought the only reason the movie has any power or any guts is because I'm telling you directly what I experienced and what I felt. The whole film and the style in which it's cut, the style in which the music and the sound design are done, are my best effort to communicate to you what I was going through at the time.
Yeah.
And how I was feeling and how, you know, I'm just by proxy and guessing Andrew's parents were feeling through the whole thing. And Andrew's parents, as you can probably tell from the movie, are basically like second parents to me. I kind of grew up in their house on, you know, every other weekend, you know, so
yeah.
we have a very close bond that way too. And I think in a way putting this movie out there has been, well, number one, it's been really helping their activism. And number two, I think it's been a really healing process for them to meet so many wonderful strangers after every screening of the movie who just really connect with what they went through and just offer so much love and support. And just after every screening is over, that they come to, like, everyone in the audience is lining up to give them a hug. So,
absolutely.
That's honestly been my favorite thing so far from screening this movie, is just seeing people, you know, give them their due, if you will.
Absolutely. I mean, it's incredible how heroic these people are. I mean, Andrew's parents, it's something I was going to ask you, which is, you know, I mean, is it really possible that these people are so good and so selfless, you know?
Anybody who knows them, when friends of mine, asked me when I was preparing this movie finally for a general audience after turning it from a personal project, they said, well, how are you doing this? What's your take on it exactly? And they would look at me funny when I'd answer, because I'd say, well, I see this as like a real life Frank Capra film.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, and because they knew the events of what happened, they look at me like, huh, what are you talking about? And I said, well, it's about these amazing, wonderful people who've just been good people their whole lives, who have, you know, by virtue of being good people, have engendered this wonderful, amazing extended family, like, all over, that just loves them dearly. And when the worst things in the world happen to them, you know, it's the love that they already put out there to everyone else that, you know, comes back to them and basically saves them from going over the edge, if you will. And that to me is what I've always just seen looking at them, is just the love and the good that they've put out there has, you know, come back to them a hundredfold in their darkest hour. And I mean, that still, obviously, the movie was put out there as a, you know, basically an activist position, if you will, but the emotion behind the movie came from that place.
Yeah.
And that's my own expression of how good of people I believe they are. They are my heroes as well too, which you can kind of probably tell that from watching the film.
Absolutely. Well, and I did want to ask, you know, if there was any thought to, you know, doing further interviews with, you know, Shirley Turner's family, or if that was just not even something that you were interested in, or if you tried. And
Here's the thing on that. I thought about that. Her son TJ showed up at
You
can see that I can't talk about what the event was, but at a certain governmental event that's portrayed in the film toward the end. And I did photograph him there, and we are friendly with him as well too. And we did actually Andrew's father and I did see him for lunch the next day and whatnot. I'd thought about asking him for an interview, but I felt like, you know, he's been through enough. He doesn't need me kind of probing him questions, and her other children as well too. I just felt like, you know, I already know that this case continually being brought up in the media is not fun for them, and I totally feel, you know, for the fact that it's got to be really, really difficult to be in their shoes, and I didn't want to put them through any more than was necessary, but anyone who sees the movie will understand why I did what I did, and it was, you know, to put this movie out there, and it certainly was not to hurt them, and I certainly hope that they see it as something that I did out of love for their little brother, and that'll make sense to people when they see the movie. Basically, I didn't pursue them for interviews because I felt like that would just be kind of, I don't know, like, I felt like they've been through enough, leave them alone, you know what I mean?
It's definitely a hard situation because you're trying to honor, you know, your friend and his son, and you don't, and by doing that, you kind of have to point out that this woman is, I mean, let's face it, she's kind of evil. And, you know, but at the same time, that's someone's mother, you know? And that's,
sure.
So I understand where you're coming from, that that had to have been really difficult.
Yeah, I didn't try in the movie to hammer against Shirley Turner, like, oh, this, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, I have no, it's pretty obvious what my feelings are about her, I think, from the movie. But what I tried to do was present to you what she was charged with, what she did, and the evidence that Canada had, and how they failed to act on it within a timely fashion. And so what was more important to me in the movie was to present what was known about her factually and publicly, and even just from people who interacted with her, and just my complete disbelief that it was treated so carelessly.
Mm-hmm.
So as I said, I didn't. It was never my intention with this movie to cause anyone any pain, and I tried to. I know a lot of documentary filmmakers or journalists or whatever tend to go after that because that they think is the interesting thing. But in this case, I didn't want to put anyone through anything more than was necessary.
Well, I think you actually
to achieve the end that we were going for, which is change.
Right. I actually think you did a bang up job of actually presenting her case fairly. You know, it's just that there's such a preponderance of evidence, you know, that sways the other direction, that no matter how you phrase it, I mean, it comes down to this woman is, you know, I don't want to beat up on this, but, you know, she is clearly a villain in real life, you know, so...
Well, it's interesting, there was one review of the film that came out that was talking about the fact that, you know, it is told from my point of view, and, you know, and it's, you know, that the film is therefore subjective because it's, I argue every film is subjective, but mm-hmm. it's subjective because it's told from my point of view. They said, I can't remember the exact quote, but it was something like, it's not hard to see where my biases are coming into the storytelling, but it's also not hard to see the facts that I'm presenting underneath and see that, yeah, we get it, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, so, even if you just kind of, you know, edited out every single, you know, moment where the Bagbys or Andrew's friends kind of, you know, talk about their experiences with Shirley, which are clearly subjective, and you just, you know, showed the facts that she did this, this, and this, it's impossible for anybody to, you know, not have a bias against this woman, you know, to not have a feeling about this person. And you know, I also wanted to ask you, I mean, now that you've made the film, I mean, do you feel some kind of, you know, closure about your feelings about her? I mean, or is that kind of like always going to be nagging at you as, you know, like what, you know, what you could have done? I mean, not that you could have done anything. I guess the point is more, I mean, are you okay with her now? Maybe I'm fine.
Oh, not at all.
Okay.
I never will be. There's a section I actually pulled out of the theatrical cut, but it'll probably be as a special feature on the DVD where it's a back and forth between Andrew's parents and their minister about the subject of forgiveness, and I don't believe that for someone who commit something like that intentionally, knowing what they're doing, I don't believe in that personally, and I think the movie kind of shows why, because they meant to harm you, and you know what, they meant to do it again, and they'll do it again. You know, it's just, you know, lock them up so they can't do it again. That's kind of the point of the movie.
Yeah, well, that's amazing.
My point of view is not to really talk about, you know, emotional implications from her side. Like, I don't care why Shirley did what she did. She had no right to do what she did, and given that, she should have been locked up so she couldn't do it again. And why, you know, why that was not taken seriously by the government of Canada in their treatment of this case, I still cannot fathom to this day. So, like I said, the only thing that will give me any, I mean, closure is a weird word and you never really get it, but the only thing that would give me any semblance of that is if they finally change the laws on the books so that this couldn't happen again.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, I also want to talk about, I mean, you as a filmmaker, you know, I want to talk about, again, you know, you've talked about how this was, you know, not really meant for the general public when you first started, but I was wondering if in general there are any documentaries that inspire you when you're making a documentary, or, you know, when you're editing it, you know, are there any documentary filmmakers or documentaries in general that had any kind of influence on you while you were making this film?
Well, in terms of, like, just the telling of it and the structure of it, it just sort of was what it was. It just became this, you know, thing that I was just sort of creating out of what happened, you know, trying to make lemons out of lemonade, if you will.
Right.
wasn't really using any reference point. But in terms of, like, just stylistic influences, if there are any listeners out there who are fans of Alan Berliner, as a documentary filmmaker who lives in New York City, who I just think is just brilliant, and I did meet him for lunch when I was actually on my way to go see Zachary in the summer of 2003 when I was starting to shoot this as a personal project. Mm-hmm. And his work has, I first saw one of his movies, it just opened my eyes.
Did he do Paradise Lost? Was that him?
No. He did. He does principally documentaries like about himself and his family, which is interesting.
Right.
He did a picture called Nobody's Business in 1996 that was basically an hour long interview with his father who did not want to be interviewed, and he turned this hour long interview into this amazing kind of cinematic emotional ride that just totally kind of blew me away when I saw it. And he did he had a picture called Wide Awake about his problem with insomnia at the Sundance Film Festival.
Okay, I saw that movie, yes. That was actually a really interesting film, especially as someone who also suffers from insomnia. So.
Oh, wow, okay, yeah, I'm sorry, wow.
I'm not nearly as terrible as him, he's great. Yeah, he's quite a filmmaker.
Yeah, and he's got another picture that's also, you can get it on Netflix, called The Sweetest Sound, which is about his name and about how he was, his name is Alan Berliner, and apparently there are 12 other people in the world named Alan Berliner, and he's kind of pissed off that he had to share his name with people, so he, like, got all the Alan Berliners in the world together for dinner at his house. it's really amusing. That and Wide Awake are on Netflix. I think Nobody's Business is still only on VHS, which is unfortunate. I wish more people could get to see it, because that's maybe my favorite of his. Mm-hmm. But any of his are worth checking out and picking up and watching, because the subject matter with his pictures almost isn't what makes it. What makes it for me is just the way in which he uses film language. And the first time I saw one of his movies, I'd never seen somebody, you know, use film, like, images and sound in that manner before to create certain responses, and I went, oh my God, and I immediately wrote him a letter saying, you are a genius, you know, you've made me look at things in a new way. So I guess if I had to point to one documentary filmmaker, it would definitely be him. And people who are familiar with his work might look at Dear Zachary and definitely, you know, see some stylistic influences there. Apart from that, it really just sort of grew out of me wanting to try to find a cinematic equivalent to convey to the audience what I was feeling through this whole thing. And in the cutting of it, honestly, because I was preparing this version for a audience of people who did not know Andrew, who did not know me, who didn't know, you know, Andrew's parents, that the thing was, my goal with the movie was to make you feel like you knew these people and were a part of this family, because I felt like, you know, when people see a horrible news item in the newspaper, they say, oh, that's terrible, but they don't do anything about it.
Yeah.
But if you know the people involved, you feel compelled to do something about it. So that was what I was hoping, was to make you feel like you knew these people so that you would want to go do something about it after you see the film. And the difficult thing in cutting was trying to find out what that balance was that kept the story moving forward, so it kept an audience of strangers engaged, but how much detail, you know, like personal anecdotes and things like that, to give you about the people so that you kind of were sucked in and, you know, they made you smile and you felt like you were part of this family, but without giving you so many anecdotes that you felt like you were just getting bored and wanting the story to get on. So that honestly, for me, given that I know these people and I'm obviously have, you know, loved them and have known them for the majority of my life, trying to figure out exactly where the line was, you know, at, you know, cutting stuff out and getting on with the movie. That honestly for me was the most difficult thing in editing the movie, was to sort of take myself out of it and kind of figure out how do I present this to an audience of strangers and make them feel like they know Andrew and his family, but keep them in, you know, but just give them enough that they get hooked, but keep the story moving, so that and not go overboard with that. Because I did an earlier cut of the movie that was, I went on a little too long, and fortunately I had some other filmmaker friends come in and tell me so. And so I chopped the movie down accordingly.
Yeah, well, we definitely feel by the end of the movie that, you know, we kind of know this family, and, you know, it really, at times, it really plays like a horror movie, because, you know, you kind of know from the beginning that, you know, Andrew's going to get murdered, and still when it happens, when you actually, like, hear about it in the film, you know, it's you're just kind of like, don't go there, and then it happens, and it's still affecting, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, good.
But I also wanted to ask you, you know, what's next for you from here?
Well, let's see. I've got a few things going. I actually, on the other, completely other side of the thing, I've got a short film comedy series currently playing film festivals. I'm actually talking to you from the Heartland Film Festival in Indianapolis, where two of those are playing right now. I'm getting set to direct a feature early next, sometime like maybe the spring of next year, from a script for which I won the Nickel Fellowship from the Academy a few years back.
Oh, wow.
I've been trying to get it going for several years with me directing, and finally got it set up, and hopefully looks like we're going to be shooting maybe May-ish or something like that. So we're kind of prepping that now. That's also much more of a, I always describe it tonally as like Ferris Bueller crossed with Amelie by way of Monty Python. It's a much more sort of fast-paced, fun, exciting, entertaining pictures. Very, very different from 180 degrees from Dear Zachary.
Yeah, well,
so that's kind of prepping that right now, and still, you know, just traveling around a lot and promoting Dear Zachary's. It's about to be released and everything too. So it's been definitely a full schedule.
And the last thing I want to ask you I ask everybody this: what are some of your favorite movies, just in general?
Just in general, my favorite movie of all time is E.T. It was my favorite when I was a kid. It's still my favorite now.
So you're a big Spielberg fan in general? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like my top four is like E.T., Forrest Gump, Back to the Future, and Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, you can tell my age just from that list, probably.
Well, you know, I grew up watching all those movies, especially the Back to the Future movies, about 1,000 times. So,
yes.
So I know where you're coming from.
Indeed, yeah. So I definitely, those movies were mostly seen when I was, you know, in right around about 10 years old or there. So they've stayed with me my whole life, and I watch them now, and they're still just as great as ever. So I think it's a rare picture nowadays, I think, that has the ability to impact both child and adult in the same way. And Dear Zachary was kind of a one-off for me. I don't intend ever to really go anywhere that dark again. And I wouldn't have chosen it as a fiction filmmaker or anything like that. That just unfortunately happened to us.
Right.
And I thought it was my responsibility to kind of tell the world about what happened here. But in general, I'm much more up the Frank Capra, Preston Sturges kind of alley in terms of my tastes.
Well, I think that really shines through in this film, you know, because, and I think that that's important to have your kind of sensibility, which is clearly very lighthearted, bringing it, you know, to bring that to such a dark story, because otherwise it would have just been, you know, just too gloomy, you know,
it would have been impossible to sit through. I think maybe if I tried to put as much humor as was physically possible into Dear Zachary, the first reason, honestly, was that Andrew himself was like one of the funniest, you know, people just to hang out with and talk to,
mm-hmm.
that most people said they'd met. And I wanted I wanted the movie to feel like his personality. So I was trying to infuse as much humor into it as I could from that perspective, but also just, you know, and that's, you know, that's just what the people are like. But like you said, it would have been unbearable any other way, I think, too, particularly with the events that are depicted in the movie.
Absolutely. Well, once again, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. And
absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, no problem. And I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks again.
All right. Take care.
That's all the time we have for Frenzy on the podcast for this week. I want to say thanks again to Kirk Kinney, and I want to urge everyone once again to go out and support Dear Zachary. It opens October 31st in select theaters, so make sure you go out and see it. Again, if you want to email me, you can find me at noah@moviecitynews.com. Take care.